Hello, and welcome back to our podcast of a fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game of a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. I'm joined again with my co-host. Say hello, Weird.
This is Sir Weirdington Esquire.
I only marginally messed up that intro this time. I'm getting better.
No. We have established a pattern. This is we're several episodes in. You are now doing correctly.
All right.
that is the curse you have fallen under. This is now normal. It is now correct for you to fail.
Oh, good.
That is the terrible doom that has been placed upon you.
All right. Well, yeah, we're back. Hey, we made it. We're another episode down. So, it's going to be in the title. So you probably would have spoiled by this already. But yay, we're doing another two chapter episode because I need to cover a lot. I've gotten into the habit of like pre-reading the story now a little bit here and there. It's come to my attention that like a lot of chapters don't matter.
Surprise! What entire chapters just don't really factor into anything larger in the story? Go figure.
Well, to be fair, this is something that's common with like fiction that doesn't really get an editing process where they go back and trim stories. Is that there's tons of chapters that kind of could have been compressed into singular chapters, and a lot of thought isn't really necessarily carried over to them. So you just get chapter after chapter where maybe one or two major things actually occur, and then nothing really happens. But like getting close to about the halfway mark of the first volume of this story, because the story is broken down into five volumes to mess with me, I guess, to torture me personally, Fi. but we're getting about halfway through this first one, and the story, in my opinion, didn't trick me into liking it, because that's my story now, is that it tricked me into liking this story. It doesn't until about chapter 34. So, like, mark that on your calendar several months from now, that when we hit chapter 34, that's when the story hypothetically gets actually good and worth talking about. Until then, we're getting it through a lot of chaff.
Did it take you there, like, through sheer momentum? Like, you just got the ball rolling, and then, like, I mean, what was it? Was it one of those things where it was, like, a regular update that you could always rely on, like, checking in on?
Well, it was more like to give the backstory of why I started reading this in the first place. The original story is, like, I will always stand by, still pretty good. It drops off as it gets closer to the end, but the story is still pretty good all the way through. When I finished reading it, I was struck by that like potato chip effect of like immediately wanting more content of the same subject. And I also knew that like Fallout Equestria is a fanfic dense setting. Like there is an entire subgenre of MLP fanfics that is just dedicated to this Fallout Equestria universe. And among those, there's a handful of stories that stick out and are largely considered the best of the crop. There's this one, Project Horizons, there's Pink Eyes, and there's Heroes, which I've only ever finished, and I guess technically Murky Number 7, which we might touch on because I'm kind of feeling maybe doing that after we're done this, but that's whatever, a year and a half after this point. I really, really wanted to read this story because, like, it seemed interesting because I wanted to read more, but I wanted a different protagonist. And when you're coming out of the gate of, like, the end of Fallout Equestria, and I think this is kind of the reason why this story was written in the first place, is that FOE's protagonist is not difficult to like, but, like, she starts becoming, like, difficult to be believable because she's just so innately good. And I think as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate that I like Little Pip as a protagonist. But when your brain is poisoned and you want terrible, edgy stories in the first place, Little Pip, it comes across as very trite because she is just genuinely good and wants to help people most of the time. So I wanted a character that was, like, complex, but in that, like, 90s complexity of, like, well, the 80s runs of comics are really good. The 90s must be just as good because they took the inspiration from that. And anyone that knows anything about 90s comics knows that that's a bold-faced lie. That's a doomed ship from the start.
I do the drugs and say the bad words.
A lot about BJ is kind of like a 90s interpretation of an 80s comic book character. Like she has complexity and edge and darkness, and she takes drugs, and she's an alcoholic, and she's depressed, and she's sad all the time. And like that's like the big core appeal of her, I guess. But when I was first reading the story, because I love to binge stories, I binged the entirety of the story in like a couple of weeks. At the same time, I was also like going through some shit, so it's a little bit more understandable why, like, I could read this poison and find it enjoyable. And admittedly, to be fair, there is also something to be said about the concept of interpretation in a story. My opinions of the characters is very, like, I feel very different than from the author actually intended. Like, something that, like, I'm going to get into in later, like, later parts of the story is how I like BJ, but, like, not because Sombra wrote her well, but because I can't help but feel sympathetic about her experiences and her actions in the story. But so, like, I guess that's my excuse for whenever I say, oh, I like the like, BJ does this thing, is, like, the excuse of, like, I sympathize with my interpretation of the character, not the way Sombra chooses to handle her.
You can, like, I guess you're just so deep in the soup that you're sort of disassociating and reading. Your brain is allowing you to read the story you want to read.
Yeah, exactly. I'm choosing to like the elements of BJ that I find compelling about her. Like, because, like, not every line of dialogue that Sombra ever writes is bad. Not every single element is problematic. That would be impossible to write. So there are elements of the story where I find myself, like, being compelled by BJ's ideas and her character and the way she, like, carries herself through the story. And that part is, like, hard not to be moved by in some cases. Right up until Sombra goes way off the deep end and just makes Blackjack into a special badass who's cool in every way, and I just, like, completely loses it for me. But that's not for months and months into this thing. But yeah, I guess now that we're past, like, a small preamble of my excuses of why I feel condoned in reading this.
On with the story. So, last week... All right, I'm trying to remember... So we are finally in a suburb of Hoofington.
Yes, in Footsburg.
Whereupon we come across, it's called Supermart?
Megamart, but yes.
Megamart, a big box store that has been converted into basically Barter Town.
Mm-hmm.
And who rules Barter Town? The assistant manager of Barter Town. The bottle cap.
Yes.
Has donned a mothballed Mega Mart manager's uniform to claim supreme rulership over the space. We are assured by everybody's internal and external monologues that the hope for restoring civilization to the wastes is pure commercialism.
Yeah, pure undiluted capitalism.
I'm not sure, like, well, we don't have know enough to say whether or not it's actually capitalism. I don't know that anybody's able to produce anything. But there is a shitload of barter, so it's at minimum commercialism. Yeah. And so all this barter is done under the watchful gaze of Gun. Praise be Gun.
Praise be to the Gun. Praise be to me peeking my mic.
A colossal... Are we given any description of Gun? Is it like a Gatling gun kind of situation, or is it just like a directional mortar?
As far as I can tell, since like it comes up more in the coming chapters, but it's some sort of giant turret. Like it described like when BJ talks about it reverently. Well, okay, so to back up, I guess something like I feel like I've been missing about her characterization is. BJ is, like, actually kind of weirdly sexually attracted to guns. Like,
you see, that is a thing that you can sink your teeth into. I agree. That is actually kind of endearing.
it's not even like in like the right wing, like just fetish, like not fetishizing guns and like what they can do, but like fetishizing the concept of guns is primarily one of her things. Like to spoil something that happens literally, like it takes the whole story for her to happen, is that a big thing that BJ is like desperately wanting through the course of the story is like an automatic shotgun because she's in love with the concept of it. And like the way she describes it is like the idea of a lost lover. Like she is, or like, like it feels like if there was like slightly less restraint on Sombra's behalf, there would be a moment in which she flips open a gun magazine and there'd be a centerfold insert that but flips out of it of the gun that she wants.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. So she has very special feelings for the gun.
For the gun. For the arm of capitalism.
Yeah, no. So we're introduced to the Sword of Damocles that hangs over this market community, which really highlights the pacifism of non-aggression principle.
Yeah, no,
we're so civilized here. Every moment of your life will be under the threat of instant annihilation at any time by an observer at the center of your world. Okay, so we meet Bottle Cap. Bottle Cap dismisses like their suffering out of hand and points them at the job board. They find a few grotesque ones, but ultimately settle on... I can't remember what mission they ultimately settled on.
Rad Scorpion killing and, like, general salvage, and also... my favorite one, because of the loaded usage of the terminology, removing squatters from a medical facility.
Well, those were the options. Did they take all of them?
They took all three of those. Because they need every cap they can get, because they need to make 10,000 caps to solve the... Like, to continue the story. Like, this is that thing in a video game.
So our crew of, like... Okay, wait a minute. Does Gloria, does Dr. Professor have anything to say about the idea of driving out a bunch of doctors?
She seems to be kind of ambivalent about it because she has to be for the story to continue.
Oh, God forbid, like, conflict should occur.
Yes.
In a story, of all things? Huh. Unthinkable. Oh, good move, Somber. All right, so...
What a way to kill, to shoot your own potential threads
right
out the gate.
So they go do this. Speaking of Dr. Professor, she is almost immediately stung by a giant radioactive scorpion. They have to like fall back to some other like part of the waste to try and like brew an anti-venom. Along the way, she deliriously reveals that she's not just an aid worker. She's not just like a college, like, volunteer-ist. She is, in fact, a doctor professor. She is a super scientist doctor who... What was she involved in? Like, what sort of shady thing was she involved in?
It offhandedly mentions, like, bioweapons, and she was uncomfortable with the project and decided to get transferred into the volunteer corps.
Ah, which may partly explain why, like, her... Nazi, her superiors sent her off on a quiet, please quietly disappear out there in the wilderness
sort of mission. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's revealed. I don't recall anything else.
The one last thing we need to go over quickly because we need to get into the episode is that we then also deal with the Trottenheimer stuff.
Oh, that one happened this episode. Okay, yeah, okay. So around the same. Okay, that's thematically in sync, I guess. While Dr. Professor is having her fever dream and spilling the beans on being involved in apocalypse based research, Oppenheimer the pony, who my headcanon insists has Shiva as their cutie mark.
Yeah, I actually looked into this between episodes, and no one knows. There's no answer. Given in the official wiki. And no one bothered to try and record what act, like, no one's willing to go through 77 chapters of a fucking fanfic to figure out what this guy's goddamn cutie mark was.
Look, cutie marks represent genetic destiny, and therefore, if he is to become death, it can only be one thing, the destroyer of Hindu mythology.
It's probably, like, if I had to guess, it's probably, like, the dumb, like, atomic, atomic energy symbol, like the atom with the electrons.
Or a paperclip. Get it, Project Paperclip. War crimes.
Yay, war crimes.
Okay, so, and then we're introduced to Trottenheimer as a character who once existed and is now long dead, and has left behind the legacy of an implausible weapon that has no obvious triggering mechanism that the party takes along with them.
Yes, that seems sane and sensible.
Yeah.
All right, I guess that gives us our chance to launch into our first of two chapters of tonight. Chapter 6, Play. The previous chapter was chapter 5.
Oh, wait, before we go on, what was the perk gained from...
You're right, I forgot. BJ gains the perk Shotgun Surgeon, which allows her to shoot more deadly and more effectively with shotguns, allowing her to penetrate armor better with it.
I guess she murdered a lot of scorpions.
Blackjack has a thing for shotguns, and I cannot stress enough that she is actually like a literal gun fetishist. Like, she's a sexual gun fetishist. So like her deal with shotguns is like literally in a sexual nature. It's sort of absurd. But yeah,
she is ballistophilic.
Ballistophilic. Oh man. Okay, so chapter 6, Play. To contrast a previous chapter, chapter 5, Work. So our small catter broken apocalypse ponies leave the research gun facility that they were resting at and move on to their next location to go oust these medical horses. They come across the building and it gets marked on their thing, and it's a giant, ridiculously huge medical facility that's just called the Fluttershy Medical Center, and it's a staggeringly large hospital of some capacity. They get waved on by a bunch of guards that are like outside of the medical facility proper, and they bumped into the people they're working for the contract for, a group of horses known as the Society, which I've touched on a couple of times in the previous chapters, but this is when we get our actual proper introduction of them. They're all resplendent, well-maintained, well-cleaned, regal-seeming horses. They all talk in very hotty-totty accents, and all their gear is really well-maintained. The person, their contact they're actually working with is a guy who refers to himself as Prince Splendid, who BJ spends the entire time fawning over because he's particularly attractive, and BJ can't handle an attractive of man, apparently. Who's also very nice to her and is also well groomed as opposed to the horses of the apocalypse. They reveal to us and to Blackjack what they actually want dealt with is they want the Collegiate, which is one of the other factions, removed from the area because the Society is run by a king and that king is dying and they need the medical stuff. There's rumored that in the medical center there is untouched experimental medical technology that they want access to so they can keep him alive. And the Collegiate wants no part of it because the Collegiate want to actually study and use the technology in the medical facility and not just selfishly bogart it to save a dying...
Hey, good on Cyber. This sounds like the moral quandary that would show up in one of the good Fallout games.
Sorry?
This sounds like the kind of moral quandary that would show up in one of the good Fallout games.
Yeah. The thing that sucks about it, though, is that to make the groups more morally neutral to each other, the Collegiate are also jerks. Like, they're primarily interested in with, like, the efforts of, like, science for the sake of scientific innovation and understanding of technology, and they don't necessarily care about, like, the usage of it. And Somber is very polar about the Collegiate, if they actually help people or they just hoard technology, like medical and scientific technology, because it flips back and forth throughout the course of the story and it becomes like understandably difficult to understand. what their actual stance on things is. Because everybody in Footsburg has to be a jerk. That's like kind of like a core thing about it. It's how a faction system works in a story like this.
It's also sort of emblematic of like Warhammer 40K style disavowal that like, okay, we have like profoundly like problematic and immoral like people that you're essentially supposed to be rooting for, but we can have deniability if everyone is bad, and therefore we can say, well, of course they're problematic. Of course they're extremely bad. Everyone is bad. There are no heroes here, despite the incredibly obvious favoritism of the author toward one or more specific factions.
Yeah, it's pure centrism at its finest. It's everyone gets room to talk, including the bad guys. And also we have mixed feelings about the supposed good guys, because that's just how our ethos works. We get a little bit of a description about the concept of the Ministry of Peace, one of the other ministries that facilitated the Orwellian regime before the apocalypse happened and the bombs fell. It was like the primary like center of all medical technology innovation that happened in the story. So like, the reason why like healing potions work or like exist, and there's complex medical repair robots and all that stuff, is because of this ministry. After having the talk with Splendid, they decide that they're gonna try and see why the Collegiate is holed up in the medical center and see if they can do something about it. On their way actually into the building proper, 21 and Blackjack have a small conversation about like how they feel about Splendid and the society proper, and it turns out that like 21 was super not paying attention, because it's the first time we get the explanation that P21 is not straight, which was at the time of the story cool to me. But so I guess to talk about this is for a few minutes. Do you know what a political lesbian is, like as a feminist concept?
It's not a term I've heard a lot, but I think I can guess based on content clues. Like the only thing I conceive of is that like lesbianism should be supported, or I feel rebellious against the like hetero power structure, and for that reason I will claim to be and or attempt to be a lesbian.
Yeah, it's that. Nowadays we just call them TERFs, but like before that the like second wave movement use the term political lesbian, of like the concept of like the cliched archetype of a person so man-hating that they would rather sleep with women than men, which is like horrible to like use your sexuality as a political statement like that. But that's kind of what's happening
for everyone, basically for literally everyone.
For literally everyone,
most especially like the person doing it, like that's a pretty miserable way to live.
Oh yeah, but the shitty thing about 21, and to bring it up now, is that for a while in the story, it seemed like Somber was just like, no, he's gay, which I genuinely thought was a cool move to do, because generally speaking in fan fiction, unless the story is primarily about the queerness of the main character, and even then queerness presented for the appeal of like straight people, male characters don't typically get to be queer in a story like this. So I thought it was a cool idea, but it's later revealed that he's not like strictly only into men, and it was mostly just an effort to be like kind of the equivalent of a political lesbian from a matriarchal society problem, which sucks immensely. Like when I talked about a couple of chapters before, what I was saying that like I kind of like 21, this is sort of what I meant, was I misunderstood, like I misinterpreted Somber's intent with the character, because it seemed like part of the reason why he was gay was because that way there wasn't like unnecessary sexual tension between him and Blackjack, and we didn't have to have that story and that uncomfortable tone that like slave gigolo has feelings for direct oppressor, but then he just does later on, and it sucks. Like, it's such a bad swerve.
I mean, essentially it sounds like, so I can see in your initial reading that's actually kind of interesting, like a bit like a final motivating like thing that encouraged him to ultimately buck back against the system is that he enjoyed absolutely no part of his existence. But instead, what it sounds like you're describing is that he is ultimately revealed to have more courage than the typical MGTOW, in that I will suck dick to spite womankind.
Yes, I hate women so much, I will suck this dick. Like, he's still, like, okay, in my heart, he is still bi, and, like, that story can never take that away from me. But it's such a bad interpretation of it. Like, it's such a straight person's interpretation. Like, I don't know Somber's, like, sexuality, but, like, it reads to me like a straight person's interpretation of queerness, of, like, oh, well, it has to be a reason why he's gay. He can't just be gay. That can't just be a thing about him. There has to be, like, a codified reason. And the codified reason that's decided is horrible matriarchal society that, like, so damaged his concept of sexuality that, like, he interpreted sexuality with women as being, like, painful and awful. There are...
I mean, that is a thing that can happen, but, like, more often than not, the, like, consequence of that is just being completely... that part of your life being completely, like, cut off from you and, like, living in an endless brew of sexual frustration.
Yeah.
Unventable sexual frustration. Like, that is a thing that happens to people, particularly famous among, like, among sex trafficking of abuse victims. Like, yeah, no, like, not a lot of people, like, are turned gay by it. Anyway, yeah. So...
is it another one of those ones where there's a lot to talk about? Like,
please murder these doctor scientists for us so that we can preserve the life of this incredibly old aristocrat.
Slave-owning aristocrat.
Oh, like, boy!
He paints himself as a monarch, but boy howdy does it feel like he's just like, I'm just a southern gentleman with a mint julep and a rocking chair on this hot day while I watch my slaves.
Overseeing my vast plantation!
Yes, they literally have plantations. Like, the society literally has plantations, and the people that work for it are literally slaves. Like, it's a jarring moment when the story tries to defend these characters for being the way they are. It just kind of goes.
Oh no! I have a sinking feeling in my guts. You're telling me that our hero's response to this, like Blackjack, the power fantasy, the ideal, like, response to, okay, so here's your mission, this is what we want, is for the hot-headed, like, impulsive character, Blackjack, to open fire on them? Mm-hmm. But I guess she comes from, like, a sufficiently, like, grotesque, Soylent Green-fed background that, like, she wouldn't necessarily say what's wrong with this.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird thing where, like, admittedly, like, Somber is playing the character straight, but at the same time, like, that straightness is shitty. I guess we should actually carry on before I just keep yelling about this. But, yeah, P21 is, it gets snippets of being queer. They actually talk with the collegiate, and they make they have a conversation with them, and the collegiate is, sets down their terms. Basically, they've only been able to get into the foyer of the, or like not even the main foyer, like the front door, because the first team they sent in there just went missing, and they don't want to figure out what happened. Like they're risking sending another team in to try and retrieve them. So BJ makes the civil decision of saying, we'll go in for you, so you don't have to lose any more ponies, and figure out what happened. And along the way, if we manage to solve the society's thing, then whatever. It's all good. Here's where I get to skip a massive chunk of the story, though, of this chapter, because it sucks. So the rest of this chapter is a massive content warning for child death. It sucks that we're like back to back with this as well. And I'm sorry for people who are like tuned in expecting a fun romp where we make fun of a fanfic and then have to deal with characters having children murdered all the time. But They go up into the building proper, and
but how do you know if it's serious and grimdark if not for the occasional, like, child death?
If even the children aren't safe, but they go up into the building proper, and they find out, like, gore is splayed everywhere. There's creepy melodic music being played on the all the radio speakers of the building. Stuff is just written in blood on all the walls. They see vague shadows of things moving off in the distance as they go through. This is gonna be a quick conversation about this because we've already talked a lot about other things today. BJ and crew venture into the atrium and they see a giant golden statue of Fluttershy. Fluttershy being one of the ministry mayor for the Ministry of Peace. And also, in the original show of My Little Pony, she is one of the core cast. She's well known for being soft-spoken and incredibly likable by the audience because she's submissive and cutesy and...
relentlessly meek. Yeah.
Yeah, pure waifu bait. But there's a really minor conversation where they talk about the idea that Fluttershy... but maybe betrayed the country and handed over the nukes to the zebras, and she's probably guilty for high treason. But then there's just kind of this thing where they, and this is also in the original story too, where the story skips the fact that that's like fucked up and evil, because they tend to emphasize the she meant well with doing it, and that the act, like, she shouldn't be criticized for the consequences of the actions taken to try and, like, because she basically wanted like a mutually assured destruction scenario, right? Like, if we have nukes and they have nukes, no one will use their nukes because we'll just blow each other up. But, like, that is a terrible plan. Like, that's the entire Cold War. But, like, because these authors aren't super well versed in, like, the actual fiction that Fallout is built around, they don't really seem to get how much the Fallout was a cautionary tale about McCarthy era, like, jingoism, like the nationalism that, like, America got really popular with in the 50s.
Yeah.
Like, they just don't get it. So these stories are incredibly soft on actual war criminals, is the way they've posited in the story. Because, like, okay, sure, you've made these bizarre versions of the characters. These characters are war criminals. Like, you have painted them as such, but then you are incredibly soft and contradictory on them. Like, it's incredibly hypocritical to make characters that are this supposedly this evil, but because they, like, still have to be somewhat representative of their original personalities from the show, because you can't just completely rewrite a character from fan fiction. That's just something you can't do as far as the community is concerned. These characters are often forgiven for no good justified reason, outside of the fact that they are the main, like, a character from the show that people like. Oh, God. I'm, like, three paragraphs into this chapter. Yeah. We're already 40 minutes into this episode. Like, God. Oh. Anyways, a horror movie matchup hospital is happening.
All right. So what do we find in the Hell Vault, Fi? What do we find in the Hell Vault?
They go into the hospital. They get caught up in a bunch of, like, ridiculous murder games. Like, a lot of this chapter is them, like, the system wanting to play with them in some way, and then them, like, having to adhere to the rules of some fucked up version of a children's game to be able to survive it. They get the specific one that kind of, like, pushes the story along is they get trapped in, like, a game of, like, basically red light, green light, where they escape the room, but as they escape the room, they realize that, like, Glory didn't make it all the way out. So, like, the door that, like, they get through gets sealed shut, and they think they lose her, basically. And this becomes a consistent thing that I kind of forgot about, is that, like, Glory dies, with air quotes, a lot in this story. Like, a lot of, like, terrible things happen to her to almost kill her, or she goes missing for a chunk of the story, like, a lot. And I could never figure out why Somber did this. Like, he does it just so often, it becomes, like, its own cliche in its own story.
that's going to get that is a gag that can only get funnier at a certain point.
It is the notion of, like, well, Glory's dead again.
Oh, well, we'll see her in an hour.
Yeah, like at a certain point, it feels like Blackjack should just, like, be wise to this and be like, oh, she's not dead. What did you say that? Well, every time we thought she's died, she's just come back from it, so fuck it, I guess.
Yeah,
so
that's a little like holding a funeral for Wolverine from the X-Men. Like, you just don't do it. It's just a stupid idea. Like,
it's a waste of resources. It's a waste of black umbrellas. But yeah, they have a little conversation. Like, BJ and 21 have a small argument over the idea that they just left Glory to her death, which, spoilers, didn't kill her, obviously, because I just, like, it doesn't matter. But BJ gets praised again by 21 for her bravery. I was really tired when I wrote this out, and I just said, like, BJ is turning into a spree shooter, and I don't know what that means. I think it's because, like, it's the combination of, like, oh, I'm really good at killing people, and also she's constantly praised for her bravery and valor and, like, her ability
and her ability to swallow her trauma, like her increasingly mounting, like, mob psycho, like, pressure level.
Yeah, it really is like that, isn't it? But they concoct a plan to dodge these murderous things, where BJ starts trying to distract the system so that 21 can hack into the computer system and figure out a way of shutting it all down. It consists of a common gag that Sombra drops after a point, where, like, BJ is, like, murdering characters and she's humming along to, like, infantilizing childish songs at the same time. Because, like, it's the way of her, like, dealing with the, like, stress and trauma of the situation by trying to make a gag out of it becomes a consistent thing with her. They find a terminal that exposits some of what's been going on. There's a mentioning of a team getting into this building and trying to repair some of the medical stuff in it. It triggered some sort of a thing in the system and is making it go haywire. BJ continues to mess with the system for a while and ends up, oh boy, here we go. One of the robots that they're fighting domes her with, like, a mysterious pearl of some kind. And I mentioned these several chapters ago, called memory orbs, and oh boy, I literally have a point in here, and I'm limbering up for it. I have a point in my notes that just says yell about memory orbs.
Because we haven't talked about that yet. We haven't, like,
memory orbs are the worst.
Described what memory orbs are, except that they have something to do with expositing.
But it's expositing at its height. So, admittedly, in a story that was more restrained, memory orbs would be fascinating as a storytelling tool. But because they're used ubiquitously in all stories, they become incredibly boring. So the way what memory orbs are is, a memory orb is a magical pearl that a person's memory has been taken out of their head and put into the orb, and a unicorn can use magic on it, and it's reactive enough that if you're telekinetically moving it, the magic will react with the orb, which is constantly used as a trap for protagonists. A memory orb locks you into that memory, and it's a full sensory override. And in a better stories, there'd be more emphasis on how nightmarish it would be to actually have that happen, because when you're in a memory orb, every sense is completely taken over by the moment that's happening, and you're only vaguely aware that you're a person observing what's happening. And because of the way that they're told as stories, these full sensory experiences quickly become, because they're expository, just the character's perspective that's happening. And because of that, like, there isn't enough talked about it, but the idea that you completely lose your sense of self for hours at a time, depending on the memory orb. And it sucks that, like, it's just used for exposition. It isn't used in any clever ways. And except for one story, which is Murky Number 7, uses memory orbs really, really, really well. And it's part of the reason why I really, really, really like that story. But to get into the memory orb,
that's like a perfect indoctrination tool. Well, like, find somebody with, like, a weak sense of, like, sense of priorities and like sense of incredulity, and give them the memories of somebody else's indoctrination. Like, just like give somebody, like, a memory of being indoctrinated into your cult. Bish bosh, they've had all the exact feelings of somebody who is deeply invested in your thing, that probably would carry over.
Yeah. And it's never used for anything besides, like, exposition. It's the equivalent of, like, in video games having audio tapes or something like that. Or if I want to be kind to them, the idea of, like, cutscenes, I guess. But they suck. I hate them. They're in the stories way too much. They're used, like, way too often as a crutch, narratively, even more so than terminals. And it sucks because they have potential to be a good storytelling tool that is wasted on laziness. Okay, so to get into the memory orb itself, It's a memory orb of one of the doctors that used to work there. Actually, it's a nurse, but it doesn't matter. She's a background character. Her and a coworker are talking about a new system that's being instituted into the program. Apparently like preservation tanks are being added to the facility, and they're choosing to put kids into the preservation tanks so that they could be preserved. So if the potential of something going really wrong, these kids with diseases won't just outright die, and it'll protect them. The character that Blackjack is inhabiting is expressing some worries about the system not being that good, because she feels that it would work fine for an adult who's like fully aware of their senses and capacity, but as a child who's trapped in a preservation state that is still semi-conscious, they wouldn't be able to handle like the strain of dealing with that. But all that gets completely cut out of the way because, oh boy, Fluttershy shows up to like promote the system, and they have a conversation with it. And a thing I really hate about the way Fluttershy is written in stories, and especially FOE, no one can talk back to her because she's simply so nice and so kind-hearted and so like meek that like she's got full like the Lamb of God.
Passive ultra aggression.
Yeah, like she always talks in very like infantilizing terms, and she's dismissive of other people, but in a way that people don't argue very well against her. There's a plot thread that gets thrown out here where, because when she talks back to her, she's like, "You don't actually know kids, like you don't know how they're like." It's because Fluttershy in the story probably had a miscarriage, and like that was what she was alluding to. And then after that sort of revelation, the memory orb like runs at a film or whatever, and Blackjack is brought back into reality. I believe strapped to a medical bed with doctors menacing her. It's revealed that, yeah, the preservation tanks had kids in it, and at some point they got hooked up to the system of the mainframe and got control of everything, and over 200 years of isolation drove them completely mad, and they now like just crave death.
They are also the collective AI of the facility.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's why all the robots have been going haywire, and all the weird like murder horror stuff has been happening in the story as well. We get another time where Blackjack gets pretty severely injured in a way that's really grotesque, and it's like the only reason why I talk about it, I'm going to be talking about it right now. So like, you know, content warning for gore, is that BJ gets like sliced entirely open, and like a lot of her intestines fall out for a portion of this story. And there's a lot of like graphic detail of like the injury and like the pain she's experiencing, which like it was hard for me not to feel sorry for her in that moment. Like Somber's trick got me for once, of like the prose was written in such a way that like I actually felt like emotionally connected to the character and herself.
And also, you forgot once again, and it was occurring to me while you were speaking, that it is very easy to forget this. So I will never let our audience escape it. These are pastel flash animated horses.
Yeah.
Welcome back again to 2005 Newgrounds.
Yes, welcome back to My Little Pony, Friendship is Suffering and Sadness. Oh, man. All right, I got one more page of notes on this chapter.
So like it it's grotesque to like if you forget, like with all the grim dark settings and themes, that like no, these aren't humans. These are very specifically blocky flash animated pastel horses. And so all of her intestines and guts spilling out would in turn also be like very thickly, like stiffly animated.
Oh man, that's actually really, that sounds really like garish, like really, really horrible to imagine.
Well, fine. Yeah, guess where my brain is. Guess what I am actively imagining inescapably.
Blackjack ends up shotgunning the mainframe to like free themselves from the robo gore. I can't remember if it's at the end of this chapter or into the next one because they kind of blur together. But they use the experimental like magic technology to fix BJ of her literal disembowelment, because I mean, how else are you going to fix that? That's not really something you can easily just fix.
Unvivisect her.
Just do it backwards. Just play the recording backwards, and she'll be fine. She kind of wrestles with the idea that part of the reason why she wanted to go here in the first place is because she wanted to fix 21's banged up leg. Partly in a weird sort of self-serving reason, she wanted to do so because she wanted to, like, mend their sort of relationship. And she wanted to P21 to stop, like, having Blackjack remind him of the stable. Anyways, we're almost done this chapter, and we can move on to the next for this bonus double chapter episode. They wrestle over, like, the final thing. All the children are now in sealed tubes that they can never escape, because if they're removed from it, the weakness of their state of being in 200 years of isolation combined with, like, just the errant disease of the waste would kill them in literally hours. So the only recourse that they can choose to make is either keep them in the preservation tanks or turn off the life support system and kill the children. And there's a long wrestling between the two decisions, and then Blackjack finally decides to make the, like, executive decision to unplug the children, letting them die peacefully in their sleep. And at the same time, they all bookend the story, sing a nursery rhyme that's from the show, send these children off to story. Oh, man. The worst part is I know that it never really gets this bad for, like, specifically child death again. So, like, it's part of the reason why, like, I'm really struggling with this chapter.
I mean, in premise, that sounds like a pretty solid sort of tragic choice to make. It is ultimately pretty cynical because, like, the option three of, okay, we let them out, but, like, we don't force them out into the wastelands. We just, like, build a camp here and, like, try and see if we can't develop their immune system so that they can one day, like, yeah, be like, out in, like, the world.
I didn't think about it until you brought it up, but they could have easily just been like, hey, the collegiate, like, your doctors, like, fucking do no harm, like, do your jobs.
It's like both courses, the binary presented is a false binary as presented by small callous minds.
Yeah, it's really actually kind of horrible. Like, I didn't even really consider the idea that, like, yeah, the college could have done anything more than nothing. I don't know. Here we are.
I mean, it's just the author's gotten to you. Like, the author's, like the relentless callousness of the rest of the story has made it easy for you to, like, miss the, like, sort of obvious humane third option.
The obvious. Yeah, the obvious Gordian knot, like, cut the rope solution.
Because this entire, like, any piece of art, you're living through the perspective of the author. Like, every piece of art innately is trapped in the politics, like, cannot escape the politics of its author. And the author couldn't conceive, based on everything else in the story, like, Bottle Cap mocks them for, like, the harshness of the journey to this point. Like, the only way to have, like, a peaceable market is to hang the sword of Damocles over it. No, the option of, like, just caring about these children, the option of, like, making them someone's responsibility just never came to mind. It's just inconceivable that, like, what if we continued to help them past this exact moment?
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, so that's the end of our first chapter for tonight. So, you know, like, grab a snack, you know, settle in, you know, go out to the lobby, get yourself a drink, come back if you have to. I know I would. And we'll launch into chapter 7, Prices, which gets heavier right out the gate. So Blackjack is having a pretty rough time with the internalizing a lot of what just occurred. She recalls the first time she ever killed someone, which was the first time she ever carouseled somebody, like the first time she ever retired is the nomenclature used by the thing, to perpetuate the cycle of horrible violence that the stable has. Apparently, she was forced to carousel her own father, as it's kind of implied. Like, the way he's described is in a very, like, lovingly fatherly tone. And his physical description kind of matches a little bit of Blackjack's. So it's sort of implied that she was forced to murder her own dad. And, like, it really doesn't spend a lot of time on that scene, which is surprising given, like, Somber's, like, really, like, man-focused storytelling that, like, that wouldn't be a big critical thing about her. Here we are. She killed her own father at the behest of her mother, which is really dire. Like, really, really dire storytelling there. I believe it was in an like in story, like the Thermion like argued to propagate the efforts of being part of the security team. But she waxes lyrically on the notion of her adding to her body count another 40, because it was like the total of children murdered was 40. She let 40 extra children die today.
And they were all like, given, I mean, her two options were kill these children or kill these children.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah, kill these children slowly or quickly was like the two options really given. But yeah, they exit the building pretty worse for wear. The society and the collegiate kind of bicker over like the actual way that the chips are going to fall, and BJ just kind of loses it on them and forces them to make a sort of like deal between the two of them. Boy, BJ continues to have a breakdown because she's just not taking this well. This is where the story gets getting confusing in this chapter, is that something that Sombra likes to do a lot is he'll like page break into a completely another thing happening. Like it'll skip forwards without like a lot of explanation of like where we ended up, because like it's, I think it's to try and mirror the idea of like random encounters that happen in transit in something like Fallout. So a lot of times they'll just be on the road getting back to another location and fighting people, and there's no setup of how that happened. But they fight a bunch of what they immediately assume to be raiders, and they find out are slavers. And this is the first time Blackjack has any interaction with slavery, I guess. Well, not really, but you know, the story thinks this is the first time Blackjack dealt with slaves.
Okay.
Well, okay, so, like, my point is, like, the point I'm making is that, like, she gets super bent out of shape about the idea of slavery, but, like, what did she think fucking the males were in the, like, the, in their matriarchy fash zone was? Like, she loses it really hard on them, but, like...
Yeah, no, like, so they're, like, breeders, but for fruit picking. Okay. Like, why wouldn't that just be the calculus?
Like, yeah, like, I don't want a character who's, like, an out-and-out fash like that, but, like, it sort of hit me, like, how inconsistent that is, besides the idea that, like, well, yeah, slavery's bad, obviously, and Blackjack is a good character, so she'd be opposed to slavery, but, like, would she, though, thinking on it, at any amount of time? But, yeah, she loses on them, and one of them meekly kind of, like, cries out that she's doing this to, like, get money to protect her family, and... BJ kind of, like, does the cool guy thing of, like, loading the SMG to her head telekinetically and then, like, firing it into the sky. Like, she can't bring herself to actually kill this person, but is still angry about it. They have a sort of conversation about the idea that, like, Blackjack has become a killer and...
Wait. Well, hold on. Okay. Just to clarify, the shooting into the sky, is it meant to, like, scare off this slaver? Or is it just the most 90s thing ever of the black clad protagonist falling to their knees and opening fire into the air while crying?
Kind of, but it's also like to like intimidate the slaver. Okay. So, it's the like, I can't kill you, but I want to kill you. So like, I have to shoot this gun, but I can't shoot this gun at you or it'll kill you. So I'm just going to empty the clip into the sky. It's that scene in Point Break, basically, but without any of the like emotional context.
Now I'm half remembering like a World of Darkness book cover that has like a vampire in a black trench coat crying blood in the rain with like fire, like firing guns in each hand into the air.
So 90s. It's so incredibly 90s. Anywho, we then skip forward and they're fighting raiders now. It gets, like, the snap cut is just as disorienting as I just described. they polish off the raiders in, like, a sentence. Because the only real reason why this matters is because Glory cuts one of their heads off and Blackjack...
Oh, how do they find her, by the way? Like what did...
Oh, crap. She just falls out of a vent, basically. While like BJ's being operated on, it's what allows them to like survive. But like it was such a detail that like wasn't important to me. Like because like Glory survives. It's a running. It's kind of a meme about the story. But yeah, they get back. Like she cuts off one of the raiders' heads. Blackjack is, you know, obviously kind of messed, like weirded out by this. And Glory's like, well, the description of the what you've been telling me about the raiders and the way they've been acting. I think they might have a disease that's making them like this, which of course, because this is a story and all theories are inevitably true, they do. Like to give away something that like the story spends a lot of time like hemming and hawing about, the raiders in the story basically have mad cow disease. Like the way it's described as a prion disease that affects their brain and makes them go nuts. So it's basically mad cow. So raiders in the story, to excuse why they're just violent, unrepentant killers who cannibalize other ponies, is because they have mad pony disease.
They have the crazies disease. They yes. have 1973's the crazies.
They've gone mad. Yeah, it's like one of those horror flicks that was basically just like, what if a barnyard animal was evil? Like, there was a lot of those that were really popular direct to like VHS kind of horror movies that like, oh, the sheep are eating the genetically modified corn, and now they're evil and want blood. But it's like that. But yeah, it's kind of I'm very neutral on it as a raider thing, because like I don't like raiders in stories anyways. It occurred to me up into this very moment that I have never explained what a raider is, at least from a story perspective, because my brain just kind of assumed you'd know if you've
been. I mean, basically from the description, like all I've envisioned is the Reavers from Firefly, and that seems to have held pretty much true, like right down to the like medical condition being the source the cause for it.
Yeah, the raiders in like to explain to our audience if they've never played a Fallout for some reason they're listening to this podcast. A raider is like is literally just there to be like cannon fodder enemies. They're totally irrelevant to the story most of the time, and they just want to kill and murder. And they wear very little armor, and they're just there to be a blood crazed monster. This story at least makes the effort to try and make that explanation of it. No, now knowing that it's basically just a thing from Firefly doesn't surprise me, because Somber's writing style is typically like, hey, this is a reference to something, and you just kind of have to take it as is. But yeah. Anyways, after they whirlwind dervish their way through a bunch of raiders and then decapitate them for science, we get to listen to our favorite character come back up on the radio, DJ Human. They pop up on the radio. They're like, hey, yow, security's doing some great work out in the wastes. Been like 20 minutes, but apparently like, well, we don't know the stretch of time, but it's been like narratively 20 minutes. But here's my radio news state, like news anchor opinion on her dealing with the society in Cleach.
You folks at home may be wondering how the hell I know about any of this, and don't worry about it. Coming up next on the dial is some golden oldies.
Yeah, it's definitely some golden oldies.
But our preferred take on DJ Human. Hello, audience. I'm sure you'll be glad to know that the security mayor is out there doing some good work for us this afternoon. It's been about 20 minutes since our last broadcast. Some raiders have been dealt with. It's all very, very good. Up next is 20 minutes.
We're already running long for time, so...
Sorry.
Not you. But I won't belabor this too much, but there's a kind of discussion about like the nature of sensationalism in radio, and how BJ is talked up a lot as some sort of hero, despite the fact that she's killed a bunch of people. And this story does the same thing that FOE does, but where DJ Human isn't, like, basically kind of lies through omission about a lot of the details of things that happen to try and, like, get people to be hopeful that they're heroes out in the waste. And, God, I can't even really talk about it in this chapter because it's going to come up in later parts. Anyways, to move on to the bulk of this is BJ... the conversation is like, so a thing I guess like I forgot about this chapter is like, something I think is kind of interesting, at least from a prose perspective, is this entire chapter BJ is like, so I looked into this because we were talking about this like before, but the broader term for this is cognitive distortion, because we couldn't figure out if it was catastrophizing or not. But every single time someone says anything positive about her in this chapter, she's constantly mentally editing it to be far more negative. Like the concept is what I found out of this is called minimalizing. Like she completely downplays all of her achievements in this chapter and previous chapters because it's counterweighted in her mind against the murders she's committed, and it's also punctuated with her like tallying up all of the people she's killed or let get killed so far in the story, And then she kind of has a mental breakdown, like a genuine panic attack, like over the realization that like that total just jumped by 40 bodies. And that she as good as pulled the trigger as far as she's concerned.
Okay. All right. Yeah, the sentimentality of that whole story is now completely, like, I could see in theory how that could actually be moving, and now it's completely ruined for me because it's all just an artificial, like, mechanism to, like, artificially make her, like, feel like she has to regret something. When she could just as easily be regretting, like, her entire life up to this point, like, having finally being able to travel the world and see that, like, not everybody converts, like, their neighbors into Soylent Green, and that the, like, eugenic, like, carouseling of all males past a certain age turns out to be not necessary for everyone.
Or normal.
Like, yeah, she could be having an existential crisis over that, but no, we're going to artificially create a scenario in which she, like, has to kill toddlers. Even though, like, even in that scenario, she didn't. Like, yeah.
Well, this is a common problem with the concept of the Thermian argument. Like, the story gives an argument for why, like, it was ultimately something she had to do. But, like, the story out of the vacuum of itself, like, that just isn't justified. Like, none of her, like, I can't help but feel bad for BJ because, like, the author constantly pits her against, like, emotionally unwinnable situations. Like, she is constantly pitched into circumstances that no one could have made a good call on, but, like, the burden is put completely personally on her instead of anyone else in the story, which becomes, like emotionally exhausting. Like, the story becomes, like, a trial to consume, not just because it's bad, but, like, it's so emotionally daunting. Like, it's hard not to be deeply affected by a character who actually is constantly near suicidal to directly suicidal because she's just so damn depressed all the time. And, like, the prose about it is good enough that it's hard not to be emotionally affected by it. Like, it's bizarre that, like, I feel manipulated, but at the same time, like, still on board. Like, I hate the author, but still like the character, if that makes any sense.
I don't know, like, it almost feels like, secretly, on some bizarre meta level, the author is our antagonist.
the real bad guy was somber.
In some ways, our protagonist is the author's better angels, who, like,
the author's victim, essentially.
I mean, who is by extension themselves. So, anyway, so all right, so on with the story. We've butchered a bunch of raiders, and then, like, sort of literally butchered them for dissection purposes. The radio plays singing Blackjack's praises. She does a funny. What do you mean I'm funny? Like some sort of clown? Am I a clown to you?
Because Sombra didn't know how to transition the scene, she panic attacks into unconsciousness and wakes back up in the Megamart. She has a small conversation with Bottle Cap. I'm really rushing now because we're really running for time. But she has a conversation with Bottle Cap about hero worship and how Bottle Cap in her horrible libertarian capitalist opinion doesn't believe in the concept of heroes, and she'd rather just, like, people be themselves, and she doesn't believe in the concept of, like particularly exemplary figures outside of people who just earn their place. We have a discussion about the way the Finders work, which is not just capitalism, but nepocratic capitalism, because Bottle Cap is fighting over the inheritance to all of the Finders from her two other sisters, Caprice and Ursary, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing right. And they all have usury.
It's probably user. If it isn't usury, it is now.
but they all have
caprice,
different
as in, like, capricious and usury.
Yes.
Okay.
Whoops. Caprice is a drug peddler and a sex peddler, and Ursary runs the slavery market.
Yep.
BJ makes the decision that she wants to deal with the slavers, and she can't officially work for Bottle Cap against this because of the conflict of interest, but she starts taking jobs that are around that area just in case she wants to help the people that are there. But yeah, there's a lot to talk about the idea that, like, the Finders are not just capitalists, but they're capitalists that inherit their position entirely through nepotism.
They're paleo oligarchs.
Oh, Christ.
Paleo Plutarchs, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Also, Bottle Cap is a pretty shitty, like, marketeer, because instead of having a sort of, like, Randian Lex Luthor, like, shitting on the concept of, like, heroes who are, like, looked upon well for, like, doing good things, if she was really any good at making money on her own merits, her immediate first response is, that is exquisite marketing. I would like to take you under my wing as an asset. A good name is good as Bottle Cops itself.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We got to wrap this up quick before it's a 2-hour long podcast. BJ then plays some poker because, you know, got to use her goddamn genetic talents for something, and drinks whiskey for the first time. And this is where we start the author doesn't understand how alcohol works arc of our narrative, because whiskey might as well be a goddamn power up as far as blackjack is concerned. She drinks her whiskey and gets kind of blitzed. Just as that's happening, fucking what'd you call him, Uniquizzling?
Yeah.
U21 shows back up into the goddamn story finally, and she tracks him down in the market, and as she confronts him, U21 does a smart thing by just using his telekinesis to strangle her so that she can't call out. And as he's doing this, Deus makes his grand reentrance into the story. He shows up and intimidates and talks about all the horrible things he's going to do to Blackjack because she's pissed him off. BJ does, like, so far, like, one of the few things I've actually genuinely think was interesting and clever. So they're in Megamart, right?
Yeah.
She does the smart thing, and she telekinetically fires one of Deus's stupid battle saddle cannons and fires it into the roof, which prompts the gun, like, the gun, praise be to the gun, to, like, swivel around and fucking shoot Deus for doing so. And this is when we get Blackjack saying, the wrath of gun, like, this is the first usage of it.
Praise be to gun.
Praise be to gun, the market aggression. He broke the non-aggression pact first, so he must die. He must be destroyed on the spot. But yeah, it's like the one, so far I've been like the one clever bit of gunplay that I thought was like worth even talking about in the story that isn't just horrible violence being enacted on a character. But yeah, they severely wound Deus. They blow off one of his cannons.
Also, what sort of idiot institution is this? Like, since time immemorial, you walk into a marketplace, you especially like an indoor marketplace that is like guarded with walls, the first thing you do is like check your irons at the door. Like,
yeah, well, the idea is that you can't with Deus because he is a gun.
Then he can't come in! Dismantle that shit!
it doesn't make any sense. But yeah, Deus, they get into a very small gunfight because like the gun, despite being a super cannon, can only fire a couple of times because it's only loaded with a couple of rounds. Because in theory, anything that got shot by it wouldn't live through more than one shot, except for Deus.
I mean, it's a surprise. Okay, so it is a cannon and not like a gun.
As far as I can tell, when BJ's fawning over it, she describes it as it looks like it can fire I beams. So I'm assuming it fires one incredibly large round is what I'm taking from it. But yeah, we're almost done this chapter. We can do our wrap up and funny bits. Deus. Gets into the gunfight, and then it gets called off by the guards coming up and menacing everybody. Deus immediately tries to buy Blackjack's like safety off of Bottle Cap, and Bottle Cap doesn't listen, because, you know, whatever. They've got a good word with Bottle Cap. So instead, Deus does his second plan idea, which is immediately puts a bounty on Blackjack's head, which is worth like 50,000 caps or whatever. And then he storms out of the building like in a huff because he can't you know claim Blackjack and her stupid pip buck with the dumb Maltese.exe off in the moment. So they have a little bit of a denouement wrap up where they patch up Blackjack because despite getting toughed up in the conflict, And they talk a little bit about Deus, and they mention the reason why he's so big and tough and so hard to deal with is he's one of the Reaper's top executives, specifically immediately underneath the guy who runs it, which is Big Daddy, is his four horses, the Apocalypse.
Okay.
They even make a joke about, yeah, they do in fact call themselves the Four Horse of the Apocalypse. Which
the Four Dudes of the Apocalypse.
Which leads into a lot of questions. Like, since we're already running long, fuck it. That implies there's a Bible, and that there's like a section that mentions the Four Horses of the Apocalypse in it. But like, I guess that's actually not that surprising, because like in the story, the princesses have been elevated to godhood, and like there's a religion about it in the story. So like, yeah, they refer to them as the goddesses in the story, which is something I've kind of forgotten to impart to the audience, because it didn't seem relevant until this very moment. But yeah, that means that there's like a pony Bible, and there's a pony, like yeah, there's, that implies like a lot of things. Like, does that mean that there's a pony Jesus? Is there like a pony Old Testament? Who's pony God in this context? Like, is it the princesses? Does that mean that there's stories about like the princesses turning like Sodom and Gomorrah into salt? Like, is that a thing that happened? Is there a pony Gomorrah? Are there pony angels? What are those in the context of the story? Like, it brings up so many questions, just adding this really stupid little bit of lore into the naming convention so haphazardly like this. But yeah, I guess that's our episode. Did you got any notes for me, Weird, before we close out the show?
Fucking... Now all I can think about is the incredibly exploitable system of Megamart, and how, like, incredibly easy it is would be to, like, completely fuck off the place's purpose and make it unusable. Like,
sorry, the what's purpose?
Its whole purpose as a market, like, as a supposedly neutral space. Yeah, its whole purpose as a market and as a supposedly safe, neutral space. Like, if the hosts don't even force people to check their irons at the door, then the Panopticon, like, loses a lot of its, like, peacekeeping value as an intimidation deterrent. Like, immediately after this day, when it is proven that you can have a full-on gunfight inside this place, and that people, like,
just immediately vaporing everyone.
Yeah, and that it, like, only has two rounds. Like, if I needed to, like, murder somebody, like, I would take them on while their, like, guard is down in this space, like an idiot, and, like, use one of my telekinetic friends to have a gun fire, like, on their person. Then they're gone. Or alternatively, like, okay, I just set up a couple spots wherein, like, guns fire off, like, at a distance from my operatives to cause a ruckus, and then I can steal whatever the fuck. I can do whatever illegitimate thing I want to do while Gun is deafening everybody with its two shots.
So it's kind of amazing to think about, though, that, like, again, accidental implication on the story's behalf, though, that the Gun, praise be to the Gun, is an absolute paper tiger.
Like, yes. Basically,
it's just the threat of being eviscerated by it, but like any sufficiently any sufficiently privileged, like, individual is more or less completely exempt of the consequences. Like, Deus doesn't even really get especially roughed up by this thing. Like, yeah, sure, he gets, like, banged up and he loses a cannon, but, like, whatever.
Oh yeah, no, he violated every principle of this supposed space, and, like, now everyone knows. Everyone will know that, like, oh, if Deus wants to, like, strangle and kidnap you or just shoot you on sight in this space, he can, and nothing will happen to him. Like, he won't be barred from ever entering again. Like, anybody of sufficient privilege has carte blanche. Like, their prestige and aristocratic, like, power follows them into this space. Like, so it's not safe. Like, I don't know why anyone would do their bartering here.
Use this space ever again? Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's not really well thought out, that's for sure. It is fascinating as like a thematic principle, though, the idea that like, oh whoops, I accidentally made a metaphor that even in itself, like a metaphor for capitalism that in itself espouses the fault of like pure ANCAP capitalism, like pure unregulated capitalism, is the only thing protecting everyone, doesn't work.
Oh shit, that's right. If they banned him, it would be an infringement on his libertarian freedoms.
Yeah, on his individual rights.
So they can't deny him entry for any behavior.
Yeah, because that would go against the basic notion of like the capitalistic sense of identity. So yeah, they can't actually do anything, and it's completely like a moot point.
Well, anyway, he's fine. I'm Sir Weirdington Esquire. Praise be to God. This has all been a terrible mistake.